Court of Appeals, Division 1 is now in session.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. We're here for oral argument in our case number 1, CACV 25-0830, Hendricks Properties LLC versus DJL Investments LLC. As a reminder, the proceedings are being video recorded and live streamed. The recording will be uploaded to the court's YouTube channel in the next day or two. Counsel, when you begin your argument, please identify yourself and your client. Each side will have 20 minutes. The appellant may reserve time for rebuttal. However, you are responsible for keeping track of your own time. We have read the briefs and conferenced the case. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lynn Allen. I represent the appellant DJL AZ Investments LLC. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this case involves two separate claims. We have a complaint that was brought to refund loan funds that have been impounded for payment of items that would come due during the term of the loan. The plaintiff contends that those should have been returned to it when the deed in lieu of foreclosure was recorded. Second issue has to do with DJL's counterclaim for fraud, and that would be fraud in the inducement of the loan that brings us here today. On the first claim, I just wanted to make a couple of points, and then if you have questions, I would turn to the fraud claim as being the more complex. One of the things the trial court found, well, first of all, we have a deed in lieu of foreclosure. And Mr. Hendricks approached DJL to take that deed in lieu of foreclosure when the company defaulted on the first interest payment that became due. At that time, according to the promissory note, the entire balance of the loan became due. And that would include the funds that were held in the impound count by the lender. Mr. Hendricks approached DJL and said that he would like to give a deed in lieu of foreclosure in exchange for cancellation of the promissory note, and said, all I want from you is $5,000. DJL agrees to pay $5,000. One of the things the trial court focused on was that there were no discussions about the impound account, and that was somehow dispositive of the issue. I would submit to the court that the jury could find the mere fact that Mr. Hendricks did not raise the return of the impounded funds is evidence that he did not expect or request that those funds be returned to him. So that's our position on the impound account. There are facts in dispute that...
Does the request, I mean, even if he hadn't requested it, if he later realized he had a legal right to it regardless of his request, how does his... not requesting it, what could a jury find from that if legally the funds were being held as a disbursement from the $1.5 million? What does their request, not request, what could a jury do with that in light of the law?
Because the parties entered into an agreement, and the agreement was a payment of $5,000 in exchange for the deed in lieu. And the fact that he had a, if his position is, I didn't realize that I was entitled to that money back. That would be a legal error on his part, and I think that the jury could conclude that he would be charged with that error. If he didn't realize it before he entered into the contract, he shouldn't be relieved from the contract.
Well, your client didn't raise it either, though. I mean, your client didn't say, I'm sitting here on $130,000 of this loan. I intend to keep it. Because if that had been made clear, then the deed in lieu and the $5,000 may have been a completely different agreement. I mean, I guess you're crediting that, you're saying it, you're holding it against Hendricks that they didn't mention it to your client's favor, but you're also discrediting the fact that your client didn't raise it either.
So we have two arguments to be made, and you've cogently made the opposite argument.
Right, but my underlying question is legally, if your client didn't have a right to hold those funds once the default happened, what difference does it make factually who brought up what? I guess my question is, is the legal answer more important here about whether your client had a right to retain the funds or whether Hendricks had a right to reimbursement of the funds? What difference does their who said what when and what they, if legally there's an answer.
Because they entered into an agreement, and that's our position.
That didn't mention the funds. I mean, that's the whole problem, right, is that the agreement didn't mention the funds. And so legally we have to decide whose funds are they.
And our position is that the contract resolves that issue. Mr. Hendricks requested $5,000. DJL agreed to pay $5,000, and that resolves the issue of how much money Hendricks gets from the transaction. That's our position.
Okay.
Whether Hendricks initially had the right to have that money refunded upon, let's say, foreclosure of the loan. The parties didn't go through a deed in lieu, an agreement, a contract. That's a whole different issue. Hendricks Properties agreed to give up the title to that property in exchange for $5,000. And, you know, the fact that it gave up the right to any funds held in impound, I think, is important. And I think the jury would be entitled to weigh the credibility of the witnesses and to look at the party's contract and make those decisions. And again, I would return to, in terms of the legal issue, DJL was entitled to keep the property in its possession, the funds, which are really not property, but the funds in its possession.
Based on what, though? I mean, isn't
based
that
on
the question in this case, is what authority did they have to keep money that was from a loan to another entity that was dispersed, part of it was dispersed to your client for a specific purpose, which purpose ended at the point that Hendricks defaulted. The purpose of holding those funds was to pay the assessment. That was linked to a contract that had been broken. And so the whole point of why they were holding the funds was no longer, they had no obligation to pay the money from those funds. They didn't have a contract with Hendricks anymore. So what is the, I mean, you just said they had the authority to keep it, but isn't that what this whole case is about? Did they?
Yes, and I would refer, Your Honor, to our reply brief where we talk about the promissory note itself, which provides that immediately upon default, without demand or notice, the entire balance of the promissory note becomes immediately due and payable. And that was prior to the deed in lieu of foreclosure transaction. And that would be... it's Exhibit 42, our statement of
facts.
But
at the same time, you're saying that the deed in lieu and the $5,000 is what satisfied the loan.
Absolutely.
Okay. So if the loan is satisfied with the deed in lieu and the $5,000, then how are they additionally satisfied by another $130,000?
That's not what I meant to convey.
Okay.
The acceleration of the amount due under the promissory note is an acceleration. The entire amount that was lent was due and payable as of the date of default without notice. The subsequent transaction, DJL had an option. DJL could have proceeded with foreclosure, could have enforced the deed of trust, could have gone through that process. And instead, Mr. Hendricks proposed, we will bypass that process. I will give up title to the property in exchange for cancellation of the note, and you pay me $5,000. And we believe that the legal right to the money that was in the impound account became DJL's legal right to possess as of the date of default, pursuant to the term of the note.
Were the impounded fees part of the sum loaned?
Part of that.
Were the impounded fees part of the sum that was loaned to Hendricks?
Yes, it was held back from the sum that was loaned. I wanted to turn to the fraud claim, and I think we have probably four issues of fact from our perspective that we believe the trial court improperly made those findings of fact in favor of Hendricks. I don't have to cite to the court the summary judgment standard. It's very clear. Credibility is not to be determined on summary judgment. And there were four points we believe the trial court got wrong. The first was that the court found that there could be no misrepresentation as to that priority lien of the improvement district because it wasn't an interest in the land. It was more akin to a real estate tax imposed by the municipality. And I want to talk about, you know, why that's not accurate. The second issue was that that there was no right to rely on the representations or omissions of Mr. Hendricks and Mr. Lords, his agent. The third was that DGL wasn't damaged, and the fourth was the statute of limitations. So if there's anything particular of those four issues you want me to focus on first, because, you know, we don't have a ton of time.
The statute
here.
Of limitations.
All right. Turning to the statute of limitations. Get there.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, so we believe that this is an issue for the jury to decide as to when DGL discovered that there had been a misrepresentation and fraud. And so the evidence that Hendricks focuses on is the May 2019 email from Mr. Hendricks to Malibu Diaz. She was an employee of the Riverside Resort and Casino. She also worked with Mr. Don Laughlin on his other projects. She received an email from Mr. Hendricks referencing, and this is really important, this is Exhibit 35 to our Statement of Facts. The reference was to Improvement District Section 7. There was nothing in any of the prior documentation that referenced that property by that description. So that's number one. That's the number one fact a jury could find. Mrs. Diaz had no idea what Mr. Hendricks was talking about. The second issue is that the attachment to the email did not reference the Laughlin Ranch Boulevard Improvement District, but rather referenced a Laughlin Ranch Improvement District. And we presented evidence, a testimony to the trial court that Don Laughlin had many properties over in Bullhead City in the Laughlin Ranch area. There were a lot of homeowners associations and other things that was being paid on all of this property. This particular invoice that was sent over didn't represent this specific improvement district. Matt Laughlin, Don Laughlin's grandson, who was responsible for this loan, and Ms. Diaz talked that they didn't know what this pertained to, and they set it aside and didn't pay any money.
Can I just add one more thing that that I had noticed that also was included in that correspondence, which was, quote, the invoice for the improvement district on the property for which, quote, the funds were impounded and held by lender as part of loan agreement. That was also included in that communication, correct?
It was.
From Mr. Hendricks. I mean, regardless of whether the property was referenced incorrectly and that the improvement district's official name was inaccurate, it's a note from Hendricks saying, per our agreement and the impounded funds you have, here's your invoice, and then it was paid.
And I want to get to, okay, to the payment, but yeah, you're correct. But both Ms. Diaz and Mr. Laughlin testified, we didn't know what this was. Now, a jury may say, no, you really should have remembered, you know, 6 months later about this loan that had been funded and that there were going to be assessments paid. But isn't it for the jury to decide whether Ms. Diaz and Mr. Laughlin were credible in their testimony that they didn't know what this pertained to and they put it aside? That's an issue for the jury to decide. How this gets paid even, you know, brings us deeper into, you know, the issue here, which was that they put it aside. Ms. Diaz is, she was in charge of initialing the checks to send them to Mr. Tokas, who was the director of finance for the Riverside Resort and Casino, who also handled Mr. Laughlin's personal interests. Her practice was, and the requirement was that these things be initialed and sent to Mr. Tokas for payment. This invoice was not initialed for payment. And both, you know, Ms. Diaz and Mr. Laughlin again testified that Don Laughlin had a lot of interest, had a lot of properties in Laughlin Ranch. There were a lot of assessments coming due, homeowners association, and Mr. Tokas had blanket authority to write those checks out of Mr. Laughlin's personal account, personal checking account, to pay those. They didn't have to be approved. And so nobody knows how that invoice got to Mr. Tokas.
Right.
We have suspicions, but the invoice somehow made it to him, and he wrote a check out of Mr. Laughlin's personal checking account to pay that assessment, unbeknownst to Ms. Diaz and Mr. Laughlin. So our position is this constellation of facts would allow a jury to find that They did not actually know, and that they should not have known that they had hoodwinked into making this loan based on failure to disclose a $2.5 million assessment that came due over time. Another point I wanted to make that's really important to the issues of fact here on the loan is that, and it may seem strange that we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, kind of the back channel between Mr. Lords and Mr. Hendricks about this, you know, problem he was having with his lender who had the first deed to trust Arena. Those text messages and emails really do reflect a sense of desperation on Mr. Hendricks' part. He was going to have to come up with over $100,000 to impound in an account in favor of his prior lender, Arena, in January of 2019, right before this loan closed. He needed this loan. It was his last chance. He referenced in a text message in the record, this is my last chance to get the money to, you know, to get out from under this burden I have with Arena. And so we think that the trial court, you have to look at all of the omissions that were made and kind of the kernels of improvement bond, fee, buried in emails, in the light of direct requests. Are there any other interests in the property? No. You know, the first deed of trust of Arena will be extinguished by this, and I'm the only owner. All of the constellation of facts with the motivation of Mr. Hendricks not to be truthful in connection with this loan could absolutely allow the jury to conclude that DJL not only actually relied on his representations, had the right to rely. Key piece of evidence I'd just like to throw out before I sit down, the title report, the preliminary title report, Mr. Hendricks was given a copy of it. It did not disclose the Laughlin Ranch Boulevard Improvement District. It didn't list it on the exceptions. He didn't tell Chicago Title that they missed it. And not only did he not tell Chicago Title that they missed it, he sent an email to Malibu Diaz and Mr. Laughlin telling them that he had seen the title report and that it was going to be a very clean report.
Did the improvement district that was included in the Chicago Title report reflect a second improvement district that they were responsible for, or just the wrong name of the improvement district that was attached to the property?
That improvement district was attached to the property, I believe.
It was.
Okay.
You're saying the Laughlin Improvement District was a second improvement district that should have shown on the report?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what your litigation with Chicago Title showed, that there were two improvement districts and they omitted one.
They omitted one, the Bullhead City Parkway one, I believe, was attached to it.
Okay.
It may not have had any assessments currently owed or going to be owed on it, but it did exist and it did attach to the property.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I am George King. I represent Appalee Hendricks Properties. I wanted to cover a couple quick points in response to Ms. Allen's comments. Malibu Diaz signed the check. There's no question that there's no issue. The trial court did not improperly resolve an issue of fact of whether they knew. It correctly resolved the undisputed fact they should have known about any alleged problem with the name of the district, which we have ample evidence in the court that they never asked about, never cared about, and to your point, Judge Bailey, I don't believe that the Bullhead Parkway Special Improvement District Number 3 applied to this, but I don't know. I believe that came up. I don't know if it's in the trial court because it wasn't really something we focused on. They never asked about what was owed on the other improvement district. It was all discussion about the improvement district. Ms. Allen mentioned briefly that I thought I heard she said that Dave Lords was Hendricks Properties' agent. No evidence whatsoever. I don't even think that's a claim. So all the discussions with Dave Lords in the meeting that is recounted where he felt bad that there was somehow, he didn't tell them, if you look in, I believe it's their statement of facts testimony from Matt Laughlin, he said something like, did you tell Mr. Laughlin, Don Laughlin, that there was still money owed on the special improvement district? No, I didn't. They knew that from the impound account. The entire point of the impound account, to make sure that the money, that the six-figure annual assessments were paid.
Why did Hendricks Properties wait so long to seek seek the impounded fees?
I don't know whether it was overlooked or whether the actual lawsuit was filed after Don Laughlin's death, which Don Laughlin and Lauren Hendricks went back a long way. I know that when I became involved, I sent a demand letter, and the response to the demand letter is, when the loan was over, you had no more right to the funds at all, which was crazy. But the question, and I agree with Judge Bailey, is what you're setting up is a really short statute of limitations. If you don't ask for the money back, you don't get it back. And so I don't think DGL's position is, well, if they'd asked for the money, we'd given it back. But, you know, we waited a month or two. They didn't ask. Therefore, we didn't give it back. And as Judge Bailey pointed out, no one addressed the impounded funds and the deed in lieu when that issue could have been addressed. And they didn't. That is on DJL if they wanted to waive that claim. There are no waivers whatsoever by Hendricks Properties in the deed of lieu. All the waivers go in one direction, that DJL waives all claims against Hendricks Properties. And keep in mind, this is a non-recourse note. Just because you have some money you can grab doesn't mean that your recourse extends to funds in an account. Doesn't mean that if Mr. Hendricks left his car in the parking lot at the Riverside Resort and Casino, they could say, well, you know, we're going to keep the car because you owe us the money. While I'm on that, I'm going second, you just get all different orders, that with respect to the impound account, that DJL is trying to force non-existent contractual provisions in five different ways, every one of which is fatal to their claim. They could have requested provisions that they now claim are somehow implied by law or what they wanted or what they were thinking about or somehow are implied by Hendricks Properties not asking for the money. They more uses for the impounded funds than the ones specified. There were only for, and they admit this, payment of real estate taxes and assessments, which under the law have equal priority and cannot be paid off in advance. That's number one. Carve out from the non-recourse loan, and that was the Pioneer case that they pointed to, where there were very specific provisions, and the court relied upon that the bank had a security interest in the funds that had been moved from the bank to an account before they were dispersed to the account and then dispersed to the contractors as they completed their work. Automatic acceleration and automatic application of impounded funds. Ms. Allen stated that the balance became due immediately without notice or option. That's not true. What the loan says is the unpaid balance plus accrued interest and all other amounts due and payable under this note shall, at the option of the payee and any subsequent holder of the note, become immediately due and payable. There is no automatic acceleration. And the case they cite on that, which is here, only they actually found that in that case, the acceleration had been waived. And so it's not automatic. And then the second thing that they say is that, well, we automatically and secretly applied the money left in the impound account to the loan balance. And then when you came calling, you know, the money's gone. And then, but oddly, we cite in our statement of fact 72 that defendant does not contend it had the right to apply the money in the impound account to the amounts owed by Hendricks Properties under the promissory note, and or that it did apply the money in the impound account to the amounts owed by Hendricks Properties under the property note. So sometimes they say they applied it, sometimes they don't. I think what happened is that they completely forgot about it, as the deposition testimony I cited. It never came up in the deed in lieu, and you're left with the words on the page. And that's why the trial court should be affirmed, because the words on the page of the escrow agreement and of the note allow only two uses for the funds, none other, and when those are done, the money has to come back, because that was the agreement. There's no separate extra agreement. Looks like you wanted to say something, Judge Williams. Let's see. So there's no additional agreement necessary to require, which is sort of their frame is, well, we didn't agree to give back the money. So, no, you don't have to agree to give back the money. You owe the money because you didn't, the purposes have expired. The impounded funds were not designated security. They weren't effective security, as DJL claims. Sobroka. They cite that non-recourse loan doesn't extend to third-party guarantees. They wanted the Hendrixes to guarantee the loan. They could have done that, and that would have changed the equation, but they didn't ask for that, and they cannot now get that. So I will turn to the, unless you had any other questions, I'm not talking fast enough. I could talk even faster. On the fraud claim, let me go to the fraud claim. There are, I believe, four or five different independent ways that the fraud claim fails. Ms. Allen didn't address, so I will start with the no damages. They received property they admit is worth at least $1.5 million. I don't think that's admissible, because Matt Laughlin did not adopt that value. You can argue all you want about the failure to disclose, but if they disclosed somebody, we would have had our appraiser rebut that. But they did not disclose. But he doesn't say that I agree with the $1.5 million appraisal by someone else. Doesn't say that. The other thing he doesn't say on their list of damages is that the litigation expenses they incurred with Chicago Title were reasonable. That is a core element of attorney's fees as damages in litigation with a third party. That's a Collins case. That some you have to prove they're reasonable. They don't even claim it. There's no, even if you could argue Matt Laughlin wouldn't have the qualifications to do that, but I don't have to argue it because he doesn't claim it. So we've got the $1.5 million value at least, we think 2.8, and then you add to that $1.55 million indisputably received by Chicago Title, and now you're up to $3 million, or we think about 4.8 with the or 4.3 with our calculation. And then you have a loan balance that was maybe $1.6 million. And so now you're down to $1.4 million. And then even if you gave them credit for the litigation expenses, they still made money on this deal. What happened is when they got the amortization table from Patty, I believe, at Bullhead City, they freaked out, saw the number on the bottom, thought that was some, and they keep saying their brief is just wrong. There's no $2.6 million lien on the property. You cannot pay that off early, just like you can't pay off real estate taxes early. So they freaked out, got mad at Dave Lords, had the confrontation. Oh, there's something that's interesting they said about Dave Lords is that all the character evidence that Mr. Hendricks was desperate for the funds, that a jury could rely on that to find that DJL relied on some statement from Mr. Hendricks. It's a non sequitur. I mean, they didn't know about any of these discussions until after discovery. So whatever Mr. Hendricks' motivations were, you have to look at what he said. And what he said is, once I clear out, once I get the property, the only interest will be held by a separate purpose entity, or not separate purpose, held by an entity, and the only two owners are Mr. Hendricks and his wife. That statement was true because the improvement district and the real estate taxes were not interests in any sense of the word. But if it wasn't true, they knew it wasn't true, and they knew that his state, they never interpreted his statement to say that those improvement district fees had been paid or weren't liens on the property. Malibu Diaz testified twice that she knew that if you have an improvement district, which was correctly listed on a piece of paper with a map that they received, that they knew that that existed and was a lien. It's not as if Malibu Diaz said, you know, I know that improvement districts are associated with liens, but once I read that email from Mr. Hendricks, maybe this one is different. They never said that. So what was their reliance? What world did they think existed based on something from Mr. Hendricks that didn't exist? They knew there were improvement district fees. They knew there were assessments. They knew that they were six figures over many years, at least two, and there's evidence we have in our summary judgment motion that those continued. They never asked for how long. They never asked Mr. Hendricks. They never asked Bullhead.
Is there any evidence in the record about why the parties chose that amount to be held back and dispersed to their account?
Yes. Yes, that if you look at the statement of facts, they admit that what the first four payments are, and there is, the last one wasn't.
There's what? Sorry.
The last payment wasn't included, and I believe that they now say they don't really know where that number came from, but it was always referenced as improvement district fees. So Mr. Hendricks knew what that number was, and he calculated it and gave it to them, and that exact number was without the last payment, because it was really close to the end of the loan, was in the documents. So I don't think they could ever be misled about what those numbers were, because they never asked, they never checked. There's a lot of evidence that they could have checked those numbers with Mr. Hendricks, with Bullhead City, with anybody. They didn't bother, because they were okay with what they didn't know, which was how long they would last, because it was only a two-year loan. And now they say, oh, it's 20 years. Says, well, maybe they should have been relieved. It's only 20 years. Maybe it would have been 30. They never asked about that. And he never said anything contrary to that they went on for some indefinite period of time. And I believe I have two statements of fact that I think is both Mr. Matt Laughlin and Ms. Malibu Diaz said they knew that once they took the property back, they would be responsible for paying the impound. I'm sorry, the improvement district fees that were held in the impound account. Well, keep in mind, we're trying to prove common law fraud here, which require, you know, clear and convincing evidence of a real misrepresentation. There is no misrepresentation. They knew exactly that those fees were a lien. Did they think they were voluntary? If they don't pay it, maybe Bullhead City just forget about it? That's how taxing entities enforce real estate taxes and improvement district, is they have a lien for unpaid assessments, but only for each individual one. Because you could never pay off all your real estate taxes and say, well, I'm done now. And if you take their theory that somehow the property is lessened by the sum of all future payments, then all real estate in Arizona would be worthless, because it has real estate taxes that added over infinity would exceed the value of any property.
Do you want to speak to her defense of the statute of limitations on the fraud and what the email said?
Absolutely. I think you pointed out that the email could not have been more clear. Here is an invoice for the money that you knew about would be due. And there's testimony in the record that Matt Laughlin admitted his deposition. In hindsight, he knew exactly what that email meant. May not have appreciated it at the time, which is not an issue of fact that halts the, that creates an issue of fact we have to go to trial on.
Is there any evidence in the record that that Mr. Laughlin or any of the entities involved were doing business with Mr. Hendricks on any other property?
No, there is no such. There's no.
So there's nothing in the record that says, well, he was dealing with six or seven properties with Mr. Hendricks, and so this, when it's misidentified, when the property itself is misidentified, and then the improvement district name is misidentified in the email, that there would be any reason for them to think it could have been related to another property that Mr. Hendricks also had received a loan from their client.
Get back to the microphone. No, there's no evidence that, well, there's no real evidence that even Section 7 is a misdescription. I believe that Section 7 is correct.
But even if it were incorrect.
Right. But okay. And then, but you know, the email also, the fact that it was missing a word in the identification of the improvement district, it's nothing like the improvement district in the title report with a bullhead, special, the whatever that one is, completely different name. If they were somehow misled by the name being different than what was in the incorrect Chicago title report, that should have, you know, been, you know, red alarm blaring. But what happened is the Chicago title, if Mr. Hendricks really wanted to fraud these people, he would have said, look, this improvement district, the Bullhead Improvement District in the Chicago title report, that was paid off years ago. So let's just cancel the impound account. And then you go, that's how you take advantage of that mistake. You don't fix it by giving them correct numbers on the assessments due under the improvement district that really applies. I didn't mean to look like you were about to. I am happy that I have 1 minute and 56 seconds left. Did you have any questions before I frantically flip through my notes and see?
No.
Okay, let's see if there's anything else. I don't know if it makes much difference, but given everything we've discussed, but I would point out that the Aroca case did not overrule Manicom on imputed knowledge of holding that recorded documents impute notice. It was a completely different issue. It was statute of limitations on foreclosing on a mortgage, and whether it's, even if you haven't paid it, does the six-year statute apply? Nothing to do with notice. So, and keep in mind that I would argue, and Chicago Title argued, then they wrote a big check, harmless mistake in identifying the wrong improvement district. They got them $1.55 million for that. So, which means, you know, that they have no damages. So, does anybody else have any questions? Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Allen?
Thank you. I wanted to address a few points that were made. First of all, on damages, litigation expenses, they're not being a disclosure of reasonableness. We have two points on there. First of all, this is not an ARS Section 12-34101 claim to which China Doll would apply, and they do cite China Doll as being the basis for establishing reasonableness. Second of all, it was never raised prior to the motion for summary judgment that there was some deficiency in our disclosure of the attorney's fees and expenses that were incurred in Chicago Title. On damages as well, just wanted to make the point that you know, they're arguing that DGL was made whole, but it wasn't. Even by their appraiser did issue a report, it's in the record, opining that there was a diminution of value of the property because of the existence of this lien, and I think it was somewhere in the $400,000 range. So there are damages that are cognizable. On the map, map that showed where the property was located, if you look at the map, it's kind of in small print, but the map was created many years before this Laughlin Ranch Boulevard Improvement District waiver and development agreement was developed. Mm-hmm. So the mere fact that a property is in a map that says that there's an improvement district doesn't mean that one existed and imposed a lien, and in fact, this one did not until many years later. On the issue of the amount that was impounded, I think one of you had asked how that was calculated. Mr. Hendricks calculated that and presented that as the number he wanted withheld. DGL had no involvement in that calculation, number one.
But they agreed to it. I mean, they knew what that impound account was for, and so I would assume that they had some interest in knowing if they were concerned about having enough to cover those payments, that you had a right to negotiate on that, correct?
Certainly. This was Mr. Hendricks' idea to have an impound account that was offered to DGL, and they accepted it. And it is in the record that Don Laughlin didn't loan money. He wasn't a lender. He operated a casino and resort and was a real estate investor, but he was not a lender, and that evidence is in the record. So to the extent that, you know, the jury would be entitled to consider that these were novices in this area, and that if Mr. Hendricks says, I want to impound money from this loan, and here's the amount, they accepted it. The amortization schedule was never provided to Laughlin or Diaz, and that's what it was based on and what Mr. Hendricks' calculation.
All right, Ms. Allen, your time is up.
Okay.
So.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement, issue our ruling in due course, and we will be in recess while we reset for the next matter.